Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to this bonus episode of Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis with Greg Kot. But today we are doing something we love to do, turning the mic over to one of our producers, Andrew Gill.
What's up, guys? How's it going?
We know what you're up to here, Andrew. This is one of your all-time favorite artists, right?
Yeah, you might recall those couple of years when I kept bugging you guys over and over and over again.
It was years.
To have the Mountain Goats on the show.
You making us mixtapes, continually trying to convince us. You know, look, and John Darnielle is a fantastic interviewer, great storyteller.
Indeed.
Yeah. We had them on the show in 2019, listeners might remember. And since then, there's been three albums. So
it's, he is very prolific. And that was a great session with them.
Today, I have an interview with him because he's got a new novel coming out called Devil House. He's become very acclaimed as a novelist, as well as, you know, the Mountain Goats being viral on TikTok lately. You know, there's... a lot going on in the John Darnielle world, but
that is just a sentence I never thought I'd hear.
Yeah, ever. Did you hear about that?
The Mountain Goats viral on TikTok.
Yeah, it was a couple of months ago. The one of the songs off their album Tallahassee, mm-hmm. No Children, it just started popping up and going off on TikTok. People went crazy.
I am drowning. There is no sign of land. You are coming down.
They're just multimedia mavens.
These are such strange times.
The band had nothing to do with it, you know, but it just happened. Yeah. This album that was 20 years old, one song just went
maybe
crazy.
Someday we'll go viral on TikTok, Greg.
Not holding my breath on that.
You need
one.
To have something people can dance to.
Now, well, is Devil House in his... Now, he's a fantasy fan, you know, yeah. Dungeons and Dragons kind of... is it in that wheelhouse?
Well, the premise of this book is... a true crime novelist who mm-hmm. is writing a book about a unsolved murder that happened in the 80s, and he buys the house where the murder happened, moves into it, and goes through this elaborate process of like imagining what happened there. And there's a lot of twists and turns. There's a couple of stories within a story. It's
good. Does he do a podcast? Because truly make it au courant.
Oh no, the character in the book does not do a podcast, but he has had one of his books made into a movie.
Okay,
so, you know, one thing I think I learned was, and that I think other Mountain Goats fans can glean from this interview, is how the music and the books relate or don't in John Darnielle's mind. Because I asked him a lot of questions about how they relate, and he told me about how they don't relate. So,
all right. After a quick break, John Darnielle on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
And they're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Welcome, John Darnielle, back to Sound Opinions. We're happy to have you.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
This is on the occasion of your third novel, Devil House. That follows Universal Harvester in 2017, Wolf and White Van in 2014. You know, I have to admit, I've been a Mountain Goats fan for a very long time, and I hadn't read any of your books until I got this one as an advanced copy. And I think that part of the thing was the books all have these very intimidating or almost scary kind of like cell lines kind of, you know, they read very metal.
Yes.
Like, this is going to be dark. This is going to be intense. You know, like Wolf and White Van, like that was described as like a guy makes a role-playing game and people die, you know, and he's disfigured.
Yeah.
And
all, well, I mean, know. There's a lot of death and gore in all my stuff. In the books,
it's true.
The books do lean dark. It's true.
Yeah. Yeah. But then, you know, especially like Universal Harvester, like just your writing, you know, I should have known this is the guy who writes all the songs in the Mountain Goats, and they're going to be filled with, yes, horror and terrible things, but also full of empathy and full of humanity. And so why was I afraid that these things would be too intense for me? I should have read these years ago.
Well, it could go a number of ways. I mean, you know, there's, I think when people veer into books from elsewhere, you know, it's okay if we're a little hesitant to think that a person can wear both hats. I think there's ample evidence in history of people who have become successful in another field, getting a book contract and then delivering a book that we think, well, I know they're going to sell a bunch of these because you're famous, right? But you know, there's a lot of those. It's like, and I don't blame anybody who is hesitant. You know,
I mean, I didn't worry about the quality level. I knew it was high quality, but you know, I was worried that I might emotionally couldn't handle it. You know, I can't think of anyone who is like had a very successful music career and a very successful book career as well.
Well, Patti Smith writes good books.
That's true.
Patti Smith writes real good books.
But fiction, she doesn't write fiction, does she?
And I got to say, although his early novel, King Ink, I don't think has aged all that well. For fiction, I don't know. Because like Nick Cave has become a pretty persuasive writer of nonfiction, like his Sick Bag book, which I was really skeptical of. That was actually a really good read, you know, and it was just tour diary stuff. But as far as novels, I don't, I know there is one, there's a guy from Portland and I met him on a book tour and he was in not a really big band, but he writes, what's his name? Willie Vlauten, right? So he's a rock guy who writes novels that are well received. I haven't actually gotten around to reading them because they were written in the 20th century. So
maybe you'll wake up on a floor somewhere. Some sort of sanitarium. Or maybe you'll call from a dry out center, from a payphone in a suburb.
I think Josh Ritter may actually be doing novels.
Good company, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Devil House, which I thought was really interesting. And, you know, I read your books in reverse chronological order. So it was very complex. It had lots of twists and turns, lots of stories within stories, retelling of stories, shifting of formats, sort of. But let me see if I can give like a really quick blurb for folks who haven't read it yet, because it is just coming out. So Gage Chandler is a true crime writer, right? He begins the book and he's living in a house where two people were murdered at the height of the satanic panic in the 1980s. And the reason he's living there is to write a book about those unsolved murders, right? He has a very precise method that he's describing at length. His first book was called The White Witch of Morro Bay, about a teacher who killed two students, also a true crime story. And it was very successful, made into a movie. However, he took narrative liberties with that story, and he is kind of, it's kind of weighing on him. And so he does kind of wrestle with, you know, how he had taken these liberties and the consequences of that. And things go from there, but I don't want to give spoilers about how it ends or anything, but is that about right?
Yeah. I mean, it is, it's the first, most of my, well, not most, Universal Harvester had sort of braiding interlacing texts, but this is a complicated structure, right? Yeah. So Gage is sort of the framing story, but there are stories nested inside that. There's at least three stories nested inside that. And really there's more.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's three primary stories nesting inside the story of Gage moving into the house and not writing the book he came there to write.
Right. It's a great book, and it does describe lots of stuff about the Devil House. But just for listeners who might be like me and be a little scared off, I don't want to be reading about all this gore. There is some gore, but it's not just all, you know, slasher movie stuff. It's mostly not that, I think.
Yeah, no, it's true. Although I will say when it comes time to, I mean, there's two extended passages, maybe three in 400 pages that are pretty gory. And there's an extended passage that is,
yes,
not gory, but very painful. And so it doesn't shy away from moments of pain. That's sort of one of the things I do, is try and find a place where there's some pain and stay there, you know, and see what might be useful in there.
Yeah.
But no, it's not. I mean, you know, even though I'm a slasher movie fan, right? That's like how I get, yeah, if I'm good at gore, that's why. But this is not that. Yeah.
Really, I was thinking about it, and, you know, I can't help but draw parallels between Mountain Goat's songs and the book, so forgive me. But, you know, like two of these characters, these teenagers who are doing this elaborate satanic artwork on this abandoned pornography shop, they totally remind me of Cyrus and Jeff from the best ever death metal band out of Denton, which I'm sure must have occurred to you.
Wait, who do? Seth and...
Oh, yeah, Seth and Derek. A little bit.
No, it didn't... No. They're not in that realm to me. I mean...
Okay. They're not precisely the same, but it is this kind of slightly troubled teens who are making some kind of art in response to trauma that is misinterpreted by others.
So in script, they made prominent use of a pentagram. They stenciled their drum heads and guitars with their names. And this was how Cyrus got sent to the school where they told him he'd never be famous.
And this was... Sure, although, I mean, the thing is, like, it's misinterpreted after an event. Derek is like... The big difference is, like, Cyrus and Jeff are both kids who get sent away, right? Derek comes from a very healthy household. Right? His parents are very protective and good parents who've worked very hard to get him college bound, right? Seth comes from a single is raised by a single mom. So in that sense, I mean, we get in the limited. I mean, what you do in a song is so different from what you do in a novel. In a song, you sketch some possibilities, right? And you don't, you know. What people sometimes call headcanon. They do their own headcanons with the subjects of the songs, but what makes the songs work is, in fact, that such details as are there are signposts, they're indications, right? And then you, as a listener, get to fill it in, right? Even if it's, you know, the Beatles' Michelle. Right. Well, we don't really know much about Michelle. You get to make the Michelle you want, but then somehow we all collectively experience the same feelings around a number of very personal interpretations, and that's kind of one of the miracles of music, right? But in a book... you write very specific characters, right? You don't, it's not really about what people bring to the character at all. Your job as the author is to illuminate and elucidate them, right? And so, so yeah, I mean, I would say Seth is sort of that type, but he's not angry. You know, Jeff and Cyrus are audibly people who get very angry. And Seth, I think, is really, he's one of my favorite characters I've drawn. You know, he's a, it's hard not to like Seth. He's a very, you know, he's got a good heart.
Yeah. I was thinking about that idea though, of like the gap between people who are making art, the artists, and the audience or whoever is in misinterpreting that work later, which I feel like happens in all your novels. And to some degree there's, you know, like in Wolf and White Van, the game Trace Italian is, you know, misinterpreted in the courts, you know, even as a cause for these players' death, right? Then Universal Harvester, there's all these spliced videotapes that are being put out there that people think is some ominous, you know, snuff film or something, but is not really that at all. And then the art in Devil House, you know, and as well, like the White Witch or story and that the character Gage has written has also been taken in a different way than he expected by the mother of one of the victims. So I feel like the idea of the gap between an artist and their audience is sort of at play a lot in this work. Is that something you're thinking about?
I mean, I think it's a fair read. It's that when I'm writing, I'm mainly just telling stories. I'm not, this is a sort of, you know, we don't often state what our theoretical assumptions about writing are, or when we go into it. But a lot of people, whether they've examined it or not, have this assumption that a writer thinks, well, I'm going to do this, and here's what I'm going to be talking about, and then writes it, right? Well, that's a very early 20th century way of thinking. I mean, Dreiser, I think, is absolutely like that. I think Theodore Dreiser thinks about what point he's going to make, and then and a lot of 19th century novelists do this too, you know, thinks about the point he's trying to make, thinks about what figure he wants the character to cut, and then draws the character accordingly. I don't do that at all, right? I'm not saying, oh, well, let me make a statement about the artist in this work. To me, that would be unthinkable, right? I'm trying to tell a story, and what emerges from the story, I think it's fair to say, often becomes about the relationship between a creator and his work. I don't know about audiences. I don't think that's not how I see it. I think questions about the nature of creativity are very prevalent in what I write. But I don't ever think, how shall I write now about the nature of creativity? Because then if I want to do that, I'll write an essay. You know,
right, of course,
when I tell a story, I'm kind of telling a story to find out what I think. And the only way to do that is to enter into in earnest, right? You can't, for me, I'm not writing sort of programmatic literature. I'm trying to first and foremost trying to storytell. And then later, after I've written it, then I can look at it and go, it looks like that's true or not true. You know, one time, a song of mine called Sax Romer on Heretic Pride, it was a series of images, you know, just a series of images to me, right? I hadn't really, you know, it has this chorus that's very anthemic, but it's sort of, the chorus just happened naturally. I wasn't trying to say anything. Franklin Bruno was in the studio recording it with me, and he said, well, no, I thought the song is about touring. And I was like, no, I would never write a song about touring. What are you talking about? I said, well, sure it is. And it's all these things you run into on the road, you know, and it feels more and more perilous. And then you hold in your heart the possibility of return home. And I was like, oh, that's a very good reading. I never would have thought of it. I never in a million years would have thought of it. You know?
Every battle heads to war. Surrender on both sides. And I am coming home to you. With my
And so that's the case, is like that when we're talking about these, I'm not, and I always want to stress this, I'm not trying to say something. And this happens with lyrics too. And I was like, I think there's a sort of a hermeneutic people have floating around of like, the author will explain to you what he meant. I don't really look at it that way. I think the author's fair to say, if a reading goes astray, if a reading says, well, this song seems to me about the price of wheat, then you go, no, I don't find any textual support for that.
Well, let me give you one reading I had when I was reading Devil House. You know, the whole thing with Gage's first novel, right, The White Witch, there is a point in the book when Gage gets a letter from the mother of one of the victims of the White Witch
Janet Perez, yes,
story. Yes. And it really changes his outlook on things, it seems. It seems to really affect Gage. He's sort of thinking about his book in ways, and the film that was made from it, in ways that he hadn't, you know, the way that it had affected this woman. I was reading that, and I was thinking about, you know, I'm part of a lot of Mountain Goats fan groups, and, you know, you had this song Going to Georgia that you had stopped playing for a while because of the way it depicted relationships. Is that fair to say? Is that...
But more because of, yeah, I mean, yeah. I didn't like the narrator and the way that the dudes sort of tend to take that narrative.
You smile as you ease the gun from my hand, and I'm frozen with joy right where I stand. The world grows its light underneath your hair. 40 miles from Atlanta, this is nowhere. Going to Georgia.
And you had stopped playing it for a long time, right?
That's correct. I still generally don't. I mean, the thing is, it also, like, that song is like 20-something years old, so I also, you know, even right. even if I thought it was really good, probably I'm kind of burnt on
You've
it.
You've written a lot of songs since then.
Yeah, right? it's not yeah. really, from a musical lyric perspective, it really doesn't really rank in my top 20, so.
I mean, you've written 3 albums since you were last on Sound Opinions. I mean, it's you're prolific. You write a lot
That's
of
right.
songs, you know. But yeah, it did sort of, you know, make me think about, like, I wonder if it, you know, echoes in a way, you know, as you look back on what you wrote.
No, I don't think so. For me, no. I mean, I guess it's a reading you could get to, but I'm not writing about myself and my life when I'm writing these books.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So, and I'm super not thinking about the mountain goats, generally speaking, when I write the books. It's like, you know, it's like the books are for me a vacation from the mountain goats. not that, you know, I mean, I love my life on tour. I love making music, but it's, I try and keep the spheres as discreet as I can. So,
but you know, one thing that does show up in a lot of your books is analog recording technology. You know,
yes, that's very true.
Definitely shows up with the mountain goats.
yes, you know, that's right. Although, I mean, the thing is, like, we actually, we tracked goths to tape, but I think we've been in the digital domain since, with the exception of Pierre Chauvin. You know,
sure.
Most people. The thing is, we actually, when we track to tape, you bounce it into the computer to edit and to overdub. I mean, the reason you track to tape is for the compression, right? It's like, that's what you want, is this very sweet tape compression that I don't think has been equaled by outboard gear yet. You get a very tape compression is sort of its own animal. But yeah, it's not an analog fetishism per se, but yes, those sorts of machines tend to recur in my work. They whether it's prose or elsewhere. Yeah.
I know that you've talked about this many times over the years, but for Sound Opinions listeners who might not have delved deep into your days as a, you know, analog tape recorder, what does that technology kind of say to you? Or is there a meaning behind it, a reason that you appreciate it?
I mean, one thing I like is sort of once something's been recorded in the analog domain, it's erasable, but you have to go over it. You know what I mean? It's like, this is a hard thing to explain, but when you track in the digital domain, most people these days, if they have a false start, they just keep going. You know, you can edit around that later. You don't stop and go back to the beginning. When you're using tape, you stop and you go back because you don't want to waste the tape on a lost take. Although what's funny about that, they in the pre-tape days when they were doing the acetates, as soon as the needle dropped, everything was going to be preserved. And I'm noticing this listening to a Charlie Parker set that I have now. That like, so if they record 38 seconds and stop, well, that 38 seconds exists on an acetate, right? And as long as the acetate didn't get thrown away, you can hear it. And that's pretty incredible, especially with Charlie Parker stuff. The listeners are such completists, you know, they want to hear absolutely every note he ever played, you know, and it's fascinating because you'll get on these complete sets, like, well, here's 38 seconds of the band starting the song and somebody yells no. That's the end. Well, now the thing is, nowadays, when you are tracking, most of that stuff stays and then gets edited out by the end of the day. You clean up the files, right, and you pull them all out. But I have to, in the studio, I have to have somebody stay rolling. I have to have them stop and go back. I really don't like at all the idea that the tape is always running and everything's being captured. Something about that takes any notion of performance away from me, right? So the idea, all this looks back on an earlier world when the choice to be recorded or preserved was a more conscious choice, right? Now we operate under the assumption that everything we type everywhere is being preserved by sort of this digital overmind, right? And that may be true, but it's loathsome, right? It's like, right. It's like it sort of removes the possibility of intentional speech, or cheapens it, you know? And so, a lot of analog stuff in my books is probably is a gesture toward the that I think speech acts have value, you know, and I think they're devalued when all of them are preserved, when there's no intentionality anymore. That's too general a statement for me to like. I don't like making general statements like that. But yeah, I mean, I think there's some meaning in there for sure, and it orbits the fact that when you're in the analog domain, you have to make harder choices than you do in the digital domain, I think. I mean, I find this too with keyboard, like with modern keyboard interfaces. If you're doing keyboard sounds in a big studio, you know, through a computer, the number of choices you have is so large that I don't really think of them as choices at all. You'll land on a sound you like, but you were unable to audit them all because you don't have a life that long. You know, you just find the general realm you want and you spin a dial and there's so many options. And I think, well, you know, that actually is a profound restriction of choice. It's more like a dice roll. Now that's interesting too, right? And the thing is, and that more compares to language where we're limited only by the size of our vocabularies. We literally, every time we speak, you know, we're facing an infinite variety of choices and bound really only by the grammar in which we speak and the subject we're coming around. And we know that when our thoughts get disorganized, then we loosen up in that way, you know, but somehow language, I think, shapes it in a way that's a little more comprehensible to me than when, you know, these keyboards, I've watched guys who have big brains, you know, going, okay, let's find a sound. And I'm like, oh no, I'll never pick one for that. You have to show me three instruments and tell me to point my finger at one.
Right. I mean, you can hear it a lot on the latest Mountain Goats record, Zarkin here. You know, the keyboard is the same sound, you know, all throughout generally, right? It's a real thing from Muscle Shoals, right?
Well, yeah, there's two. There's a there's the Hammond, the B3.
Yeah.
And then there was the it's not a Rhodes, it's a Wurlitzer, right?
Wurlitzer, right.
And there's a piano also. But yeah, I mean I tend to prefer instruments that sound like themselves. I'm not the guy. We have a Nord in our band, although I've made Matt put black electrical tape over it because I can't stand the look of those red Nords. But like, that's what everybody likes, is that big choice. And I really, you know, there's a Catholic tendency to prefer some restriction, you know, within which creativity can bloom. But yeah, I mean, the other thing is, like, I have Spooner Oldham. If I put Spooner Oldham on Darken here, I put him on the Nord, he'll kill it on the Nord too. It's all the same to him. It's like, these guys weren't that good. It doesn't really matter that much. You know? It's like, they're more sophisticated than I am. So.
Half-life of my toxins, difficult to calculate. Stock up on gauze in case of accidents. Try to keep my story straight.
Well, yeah, it's a good sound. It sounds good. I'm glad you didn't go for some random dice roll on a...
I mean, the thing is, it's an aesthetic is all. It's people who are into that, they get somewhere too. It's just not my thing.
So one thing I was also thinking about, you know, you mentioned with Derek that he does have really good parents in Devil House, the character. And I was thinking about how, you know, parents come up in all the books too. These three books had been written after you became a parent. Is that right?
Well, I was working on Wolf for a long time before I became a father. I mean, at least 5 years. So,
okay.
So yeah. So no,
I had heard you say on the, I only listen to the Mountain Goats podcast. You thought that your highest calling was as a parent. And so
sure. I mean, I think that's true for any parent. I think that's the most important job you're likely to get.
Did you have a change in the way you created things after you became a parent?
Only insofar as you sort of have to time manage a little more carefully. Other than that, no. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, it's like, yeah, this changed. Like when I was revising Wolf in White Van, this is a complicated book, so I had to print out the manuscript and be going through sections because it moves backwards, right? So making sure that everything moves in an actual backwards way, you have to start moving parts around it because it wasn't written in that sequence. I'd come up with, you know, I also write sort of in a modular way. Well, I'll write a section, right? A segment, right? Usually set off by a double space on the other side. of it. And some of them would sort of just be dropping in there. And I'd read through a chapter and go, well, this module here feels like it interrupts the flow. It makes you sort of jerk too far in one direction before heading back in the other. And I wanted it to be a fairly persistent backwards motion. So to do that, to get all the parts in the right place, and this was really intense because there was a point at which I remember, and I don't even remember what the subject was, but like, it was parts of chapter 11 had to be moved up to chapter 2, right? And because the book wouldn't have, like, it would have been very hard to make sense of if I didn't get the backwards movement moving just right. Mm-hmm. So I printed out the manuscript, and I was cutting sections out to move them around and physically be looking at them. I can't really do that on a screen, right? I need to be seeing them on the page. Well, at one point I had a baby rolling on the manuscript because babies roll around on floors, right? So in that way, yeah. It was like sort of a challenge, you know, level up, you know. Right? But short of that, no, I don't. I'm not one of those guys who decided to change what I write about or how I write in the wake of becoming a parent. I mean, I do think being a parent shapes you as a person. And so then probably some of your thoughts and convictions and beliefs, which will doubtless be reflected in your work, right, will then be newly shaped by the experiences you have as a parent. But I've always found it a little weird when somebody, has a baby and changes all their opinions about stuff. And I can't cite an example of that, but I do know that a lot of people will start writing parenting tips after they've had a child for 2 years. And I'm like, you've only been doing this for 2 years. What do you know? Raise three of them to 18 and then share your views. That's my opinion. I mean, this is sort of one of my hobby horses. I've been writing songs for 20 something years, but I don't consider myself qualified to teach anybody how to write a song. Because I haven't been studying pedagogy. I haven't been studying teaching. All I can do is tell people what I do, and that's of limited use, right? So everybody sort of thinks teaching is the same thing as just saying what you yourself do, and I don't think it's the same.
Here's another question you're probably not going to like, but
I have liked all the questions just fine. I have no complaints about these questions.
Okay. Well, when I listened to Let Me Bathe in Demonic Light, it reminded me of Devil House. And you've said there's no connection, but...
But there is a word demon in one. Yeah.
Well, and down at the end of the bombed out street, the shell of a house where my friends and me used to meet, it sounds like
Devil House,
Down at the end of a bombed-out street, the shell of a house where my friends and me used to meet. Someday the old flesh will give way to the new, find a functioning mirror inside and slip right through.
People really want to find a continuity between Mountain Goat songs and books, but that's not, and people ask me to do that too. They say, hey, you want to do a musical based on this song? And I go, no, I don't. When I'm thinking of that, the story is quite different, right? Because the in the second verse, the guy goes to New York, right? And and he's slipping through time.
It's totally different. Yes.
Let Me Bathe in Demonic Light is much more autobiographical. Whereas this is just a story. Mm. It's like what those houses I'm talking about are not even houses or motels or whatever. It's like that the analog you're looking for in that song is Palm Court of Yajna, right? The hotel room, right? Or the motel room.
Yeah, totally.
That's what you're looking for there.
Hooked up with some friends at the Travel Lodge. Set ourselves up.
But yeah, but they're similar there's a house, but the house where Derek and Seth live is a castle, right? It doesn't look good to you or me, right? But it's a castle. It's their home and it's nurturing, right? And the house in that song is none of those things, right? It's a shell of a bombed out house, right? And he's looking actively to shed that skin, whereas Seth and Derek and Alex and Angela are defending their castle against invaders. It's a glorious place, right? And it's something they convert from something unglorious into something truly magnificent, right? So it's a pretty strong contrast, I think.
Totally. Yeah. I will point out, though, there is one connection between your music and your books, and that is the audiobook for Universal Harvester. You recorded a soundtrack for it.
Yes, I've actually done that for all three of...
Good.
I think all three. I forget if I did one for Wolf and White Van. I know I recorded the book, but I can't remember if there's music on it. I think there is, though. And I know we did music again for the audio on Devil House.
Great, great.
I just don't trust anybody else to do it. Is that
right? Well, thanks again for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. All right. Bye.
Take care.
That's it for this bonus episode of Sound Opinions. Let us know what you thought of it by leaving a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. We love playing those messages on the show.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions was produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our intern, Mary Bernthal. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott. Thanks for listening.